Sharon, his arrows.
Ahu,
they say.
Akuti,
the mind with its active functions. Asha,
of him.
Shandanam,
the chariot.
Tatmatrani,
the objects of perception.
Asya,
his.
Abhivyaktim,
external appearance.
Mudraya,
by the gestures of his hands,
symbolizing the giving of benediction,
the offering of fearlessness,
and so on.
Artakriya Atmatam,
the essence of purposeful activity.
Translation and purport by the disciples of His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada.
His arrows are said to be the senses, and his chariot is the active, forceful mind. His external appearance is the subtle objects of perception, and the gestures of his hands are the essence of all purposeful activity.
Report.
All activity is ultimately aimed at the supreme perfection of life, and this perfection is awarded by the merciful hands of the Lord. The gestures of the Lord remove all fear from the heart of a devotee and elevate him to the Lord's own association in the spiritual sky. So we've been discussing the last couple days in this chapter 11, the Mahapurusha, also it's called the Virata Rupa, the universal form. Our acharyas have described in these different ways. Basically, we're seeing how Krishna's spiritual form can be compared to qualities in this material world. So all the different attributes, what they call the vibhutis, the opulences or power of the Lord, are described, like his hands, all his sense, and how these correspond with those things in this material nature, and how thus we can see Krishna as we look at material world, look at material nature, which is the purpose of the Virata Rupa, or these different forms of the Lord. And they're described in other places of the Bhagavatam. I think it was mentioned yesterday, Nagaraj gave a very nice class yesterday and really explained this, I think, very thoroughly about the Mahapurusha and the Virata Rupa. So I'm not going to describe that all again, because I think he did a fine job and I wouldn't have too much to add. I don't know if he mentioned or not that at one point in the discussion of Virata Rupa, Prabhupada said, this form is more or less imaginary, meaning not that it's, you know, made up or something, but in other words, it's not that, you know, Krishna really is backbones or the mountains like that, but it's metaphorical in a sense that it's a way of describing understanding. So if you see the trees, you see the mountains, you see the ocean, you think, oh yes, this is like Prabhupada, this is like Krishna's backbone or Krishna, the hairs on his head and things like this. Again, it's a way, particularly for those who might be more enamored by the material energy, to begin the process of self-realization, by understand how Krishna is working and acting, and how we can indeed see everything, see Krishna everywhere. And so that's really the point of one becoming a devotee, or becoming self-realized, to understand God's working. So as I said, this was very thoroughly discussed, and I don't need to say too much more on this. Today, the specific point is about the Lord's mudras, how they give benediction and fearlessness. I was thinking how, this isn't directly, just as mudraya, and the translation says, by gestures of the hands, symbolizing benediction, offering of fearlessness, kind of like where that came from. Actually, it's directly in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's translation purport. Vishwanath says, that this is what it means, this word mudra, you know, the mudra are the hand gestures. We use mudras even like in deity worship and like that. But these mudras of the Lord, they give benediction to the living entity, and they bestow fearlessness. So those are very important, and it's discussing how Krishna removes all fear from the heart of the devotee. Krishna gives this fearlessness, and thus one's purposeful action can take place. And that purposeful action is described as, of course, pure devotional service that elevates one to Krishna's association in the spiritual world.
So I just wanted to read one more verse about this point of Krishna awarding fearlessness. This is from Bhagavatam 2:16-18. It says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the controller of immortality and fearlessness, and he is transcendental to death and the fruit of action in the material world. O Narada, O Brahman, it is therefore difficult to measure the glories of the Supreme Person. Deathlessness, fearlessness, and freedom from the anxieties of old age and disease exist in the kingdom of God, which is beyond the three high planetary systems and beyond the material coverings. Very nice purport to this verse. Srila Prabhupada says, the changing effects of eternal time are conspicuously absent in the immortal kingdom of God, which should therefore be understood to have no influence on time, and therefore no fear whatsoever. And Prabhupada also said that anxiety and fearfulness that we experience in the material world is there, but the Lord, being himself the supreme fearless, awards the same quality of fearlessness to his pure devotees. So the Lord gives freedom from fear. This is coming from Krishna. It's the nature of the spiritual world is to have this freedom from the anxieties. Vaikuntha is called place of no anxiety. Otherwise, we are bound, not free, in this material world. So this issue of freedom is very important to every human being. In fact, in philosophy, freedom and the idea of free will that we have or don't have, to what degree do we have free will, this is a very important topic. And it's essential for our understanding of the nature of the jiva, of the atma, our relationship with God and our relationship with this material energy. So because this idea of freedom and free will is so important, I thought today, being the 4th of July, which is Independence Day, the celebration of the concept of freedom, we should discuss what is real freedom, real independence, and do we actually have independence? How's that for a segue? I had to work it in. I really like these holidays. I've given a lot of classes on things like New Year's, and I did actually last St. Patrick's Day. I did a St. Patrick's Day class. You know, I find that, you know, there's so many things in the material world, the way that people in our cultures have developed these different concepts, which are so important to them, that they actually put into holidays, official celebrations, we can learn a lot from. We can learn a lot about the nature of the living entity in the material world, and even of our spiritual identity. So this idea of independence is very important to Americans particularly. You know, we talk about our freedoms and our independence a lot. Every politician talks about it and how they're going to preserve them, how they care about them, and the others don't, of course. And also to other countries. It's a very important concept. In fact, everybody wants to be free, right? People do not want to be controlled by others. That's kind of our nature, particularly our conditioned nature. We don't want anyone to control us. And in modern history, we've seen so many different countries, different cultures rise up against oppressions to try to obtain freedom. Of course, these liberation movements, they usually end up being oppressors themselves, just like in Russia after the Russian Revolution in 1917 and the tyrannical czars were all gotten rid of. So what happened? They got replaced by Stalin and, you know, communist tyranny and despots. And this often happens. And in Cuba, before Castro, a lot of people too young remember, there was a dictator named Batista, very bad. And so Che Guevara and Castro got rid of him. And so what did they replace? You know, Castro being basically the dictator there. So this happens in the material world, but nonetheless, that desire is there, you know, for freedom. Now in America, going back to Independence Day, the motivation was what? Well, historians tell us that as much as the philosophical desire for freedom, there was also a desire for freedom from taxes and freedom from economic suppression. So economy was a very strong thing. In fact, the American Revolution is often called a middle-class revolution. It was the merchant class of people who were really pushing for it because they were getting a real bad deal from England. It was basically trying to exploit their colonies for their own economic development. And, of course, Americans were interested in their economic development, said, no way, we're not going to accept this. Now, others, some took this a little further, like Thomas Jefferson, and they evolved a much greater philosophical and political meaning of the concept of freedom, or freedom from tyranny. The Declaration of Independence, written on this day some 200 some years ago, is a very interesting and important and extremely well-written document. I think everyone would agree. It's kind of a masterpiece written by Thomas Jefferson, I believe. Didn't Benjamin Franklin help with it too? John Adams, a couple of people like that. But some of the philosophical roots came from people like Hobbes and especially John Locke, English philosophers a little bit before, 50, 100 years earlier. And especially John Locke developed this concept of natural rights, the natural rights of man. And Locke actually came up with life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Interesting. Again, you know, having the ability for economic development, you know, being an essential ingredient. Now, Jefferson was a little more philosophical, and maybe he thought that sounded a little crass or something. Anyway, he changed it, or he came up with, he called it life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So our Declaration of Independence, written on this day, says, well, I don't know if it's written on this day, but it's the day we normally attribute it to, says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Now, it's a very interesting sentence. First of all, this idea of inalienable rights, meaning that there are rights or freedoms which are inherent in the very nature of human beings or the living entity. Not that there's something bestowed upon you or fought for necessarily, but they are there naturally, inherently. And they are endowed by the Creator. They're coming from God. Otherwise, when you think about it, if it was just a matter, if we are just a bunch of chemicals coming together and evolving across time, then how would we have any inherent rights? How would there be, you know, a concept like freedom? You know, does an amoeba have an inherent right to freedom? No, I mean, usually we think of, you know, most lower forms of life of not really having freedom. They're more or less dictated by the laws of material nature. In fact, this is what makes, one of the things that makes human beings unique amongst all the species of life, that idea of the ability to exercise some free will, to exercise choice, determination. So that's a very important concept, and people throughout history have realized it, although they don't understand the full nature, the full meaning of it. Because it's not just, well, we're free and that's the end of the story. Obviously, we know that we're controlled in so many ways, and so many ways we're not free. In fact, we call, you know, call it conditioned life or being bound by material nature, right? You know, the gunas, the ropes of the three modes of nature. So in many ways, we're not free. We are bound. But we stand on a higher level, even on the spiritual highest level. Are we completely free? In one sense, yes. But also, our goal is to surrender to God, right? Our goal is to become servant. So we also want to give up some of our independent nature to be able to purely serve God. So we have a little bit of a contrast here. We have this desire for independence, Krishna Svarat, complete independent. We have minute qualities, somewhat like Krishna. Therefore, we do have the quality of independence, and yet our goal, our destination, is to surrender to God and become His servant. So, obviously this requires some understanding, requires more discussion. The philosophical understanding of the nature of the Atma, of course, is thoroughly described in the Vedic literatures. More so, you will not get this discussion, I don't think, in most religions or philosophy to the degree that it is so much a part of our spiritual information and path that comes through the Vedas. I've talked about this before, but one of the best descriptions of the nature of the self comes from the Paramatma Sandarbha of Jiva Goswami. And he describes very thoroughly the nature of the Atma, of the self. And he talks about that there are eternal qualities of us, of the Atma, which are that we are individual. We have a separate consciousness from all other jivas. In other words, every one of us is unique. And we are not only conscious, but self-aware. There's consciousness, and there's also awareness of that consciousness. So the living entity has that unique, independent nature in a sense that every single jiva is unique, different from all others, and has a continuity of the sense of self, right? In other words, just like we can see the simple example that we all remember when we were children and when we were younger and now maybe we're older, but we all see it's the same self. That was me. That was me 5 years old playing with my friends, right? So that sense of self, and we can extrapolate that quite easily through a little philosophical understanding, that self continues over lifetimes from one to the other. Now, according to the Paramahamsa Sundarbha, the Atma is also an enjoyer. Krishna is, of course, the supreme enjoyer, but we have also the quality of Ananda. Satchitananda, it's our nature. So the nature to enjoy or experience pleasure. And we have desire, right? Desire is what drives us, right? Desire is what brings us to the material world. Desire is what gets us out of this material world. So the Atma is a doer, or a cause of one's own action. Jiva Goswami quotes the Brahma Sutra, says the pure jiva has a nature of a doer, by doer, D-O-E-R, not doer like, you know. A doer by his shakti, along with senses. Like a carpenter, the jiva is the doer. Just as a carpenter uses the axe, the jiva is the doer using his own shakti, his own energy. The jiva is an agent. We hear this word being agentic, meaning that you have some volition, some control of your destiny. So Jiva Goswami saying the jiva has that agentic nature. So being an actor or an agent or a doer implies that we have volition, we have some free will. And then it's described that action that the living entity can take is of two types. One is our pure spiritual activity in the spiritual world, loving and serving God. And the other is, of course, conditioned activity in the material world under the influence of the three modes of nature. So in other words, yes, we have some freedom, but when that choice is to act within this material world, we then become under the influence of the modes of nature. So we need to reconcile that we have independence, but we are also completely dependent upon Krishna. So we have these two different aspects, understanding our relationship with Krishna. We have both equality and separateness from God. Of course, that's part of our concept of Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva. Of course, that's a larger philosophy. It also includes, you know, that Krishna is simultaneously one and different from his creation. You know, Krishna creates everything, expands everything, but yet he remains the same. And also that the living entity and God are simultaneously one and different. One in terms of quality, but separate in terms of that we are very small, infinitesimal living beings. So we are unique, separate entities with free will to some degree, but our real purpose is not separate. Our purpose should be alignment with God's will. And so when we say we're one with God, yes, we are one with God. Not that we become God, or not that we merge into God, but our desire, our will, our actions are in alignment with God's, and of course, Guru's. So we understand that the jiva is marginal potency, tadashta shakti, and therefore we have a tendency to misuse independence. There's a very nice verse in purport in the Bhagavad Gita 15.7, the one Prakritishtani Karshati, how the living entities in this conditioned world are struggling hard. And in that purport, Prabhupada describes this point that we're discussing very nicely. Prabhupada says, similarly, the separated expansions of living entities have their identity. As fragmental part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, the living entities have fragmental portions of his quality, of which independence is one. Every living entity, as an individual soul, has his personal individuality and a minute form of independence. By misuse of that independence, one becomes a conditioned soul and proper use of independence, he is always liberated. So it's a little bit ironic, isn't it? Real freedom comes from surrendering to Krishna, and by trying to be separate from Krishna, supposedly being free, one becomes an eternally conditioned soul. Not eternally, exactly, but, you know, we call it Nityabandha. In either case, he's qualitatively eternal, as the Supreme Lord is. In his liberated state, he is free from this material condition under the engagement of transcendental service of the Lord. In his conditioned life, he is dominated by the material modes of nature and forgets his transcendental loving service to the Lord. As a result, he has to struggle very hard to maintain existence in this material world. Okay, so that's our choice. We can be happy with Krishna, or we can struggle in this material world. Interesting that we made the wrong choice, isn't it? It should have been more clear to us. So our loss of freedom is actually due to the control of material energy. Of course, Lord Chaitanya explains these same concepts to Sanatana Goswami in the beginning of his instructions. He gives us, you know, talks about the concept of Achintaveda Veda Tattva, and he talks about the living entity's constitutional nature, you know, Jivara Sarupaya, Krishnara Nichidas. He says the living entity's constitutional position is to be eternal servant of Krishna, because he is the marginal energy of Krishna, Tatashta Shakti, and a manifestation simultaneously one with and different from the Lord, like a molecular particle of sunshine or fire. And Krishna's three varieties of energy. Then Lord Chaitanya instructs about the different energies to Sanatana Goswami. That was Majjha 21.08. And then we get to Majjha 21.17. Then Lord Chaitanya tells him, forgetting Krishna, the living entity has been attracted by the external feature since time immemorial. Therefore, the illusory energy gives him all kinds of misery in his material existence, samsara dukkha. And we experience this karshati, the Bhagavad Gita 15.7 talks about, the struggle for existence in the material world. And that state is called conditioned. And in the conditioned state, this free will is largely suspended. For the living entity, Prabhupada says, largely suspended. In other words, the pure nature of the jiva, which is to be free, is somewhat dormant or suppressed, as are so many aspects of our spiritual nature. They're still there. They don't go away. The pure jiva is there. We are here. But due to our contact with material nature, due to our accepting this material world and the modes of nature, that true nature is quite dormant at present, awaiting to become reawakened through the process of bhakti. Okay? So, now we're controlled by the nature, by laws of nature, by the laws of karma, by this material world. And our real freedom, our independence, is to become free from this material modes of nature, material desires. Prabhupada says in 3.13.39 purport, the qualification of bhakti, or devotional service to the Lord, is the devotee should be free from all material contaminations and desires. This freedom is called vairagya, a renouncement of material desires. Interesting. Renunciation, vairagya, is called freedom. Again, one who engages in devotional service to the Lord according to regular principles is automatically freed from material desire, and in pure state of mind, one can realize the personality of Godhead. So only the devotee, one who has surrendered to Krishna, can experience the freedom from suffering the material world. Now in the Nectar Devotion, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it's described that there are six characteristics of pure devotional service. And what is the first one? Immediate relief of material distress. Right? And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu commentary, says, we can't change our current body. Okay, you say, well, immediately freedom from distress. Well, what if I'm born this body and it's creating me all sorts of distress? No, you're not going to change your body, but bhakti can alleviate much of the suffering that is experienced. Right? Just having transcendental knowledge alleviates so much suffering, doesn't it? When you think about it, what is the greatest, and before those of us who were not born devotees, one of the greatest sufferings we experience is sort of that existential anxiety or angst, you know,
who am I, what's this all about, what's the purpose, what happens, you know, am I going to die, what happens, in other words, this is great anxiety for living entity, being in ignorance. And when one comes to devotional service, so much of that anxiety and stress and distress is greatly alleviated. Not 100%, not completely there. In fact, this is described sometimes, well, how can you say it's immediate? You know, I'm still experiencing some distress. Well, actually, I can't remember. In one of the commentaries, the two commentaries are there, Jiva Goswami's and Vishvanath's, and one of them describes that what this means, the immediate relief of distress. He says it may not appear immediate, but it's very quickly compared to many, many lifetimes. And the example he gives is if you have a stack of banyan bees and you put a needle through the stack, you can say the needle went immediately through the stack of banyan leaves. He said, but if, like, he didn't say put in slow motion because they didn't have that. But if you did, if you looked at it very slowly, he describes the needle actually goes through one by one by one, right? But it appears very quickly. So he said it's like that. It's a sort of a temporal experience that we have, that things seem to be going very slowly, but if we looked at the 537 million lifetimes or whatever it's been, we've been in this material world, then that we become free from distress in this one lifetime is extremely fast, right? It is immediate in a sense. In other words, and Prabhupada would often say this. He would say, your spiritual life has begun, right? You begin chanting Hare Krishna. Your liberation is there. And it is. Devotees are liberated souls. Now, there may be some time lapse there. There's just time separating us from the state of pure devotional service, going back to Godhead. It might be some years. It might be a couple lifetimes, whatever it is. The short period of time in the face of eternity is that immediate relief of distress. So the devotee realizes his true constitutional position, Jivara Srupaya Krishna Nichidas, that he's eternal servant of Krishna. So returning to our Declaration of Independence written this day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they're endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So how does one really get those freedoms? Think about life. Where is our... Krishna has given us life. Life is coming from Krishna. And Krishna has given us eternal life. Not of the body, but of the soul, the self. And Krishna consciousness gives us realization of that eternal life of the soul and the eternal activity of the soul in Krishna consciousness or bhakti. Liberty. As we've talked about, Krishna awards freedom from rebirth, the natural freedom of the soul in relationship to Krishna, no longer being conditioned and controlled by the laws of the material nature, and pursuit of happiness. Krishna gives us real happiness, anandamoya. Bhakti is there. It is filled with bliss and happiness. We just have to sometimes, dig a little deeper to get it, but it's there. It's there, that happiness of Krishna consciousness. So we experience real freedom. Freedom from suffering in this material world. Freedom from death. The body will die, of course. But we understand eternal spirit soul living on in relationship with God, with Krishna. And freedom from ignorance. Freedom from that lack of knowledge of who I am. So real freedom, real independence comes through surrendering to Krishna and understanding one's philosophical position and acting in that position in relationship with God through bhakti, through devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master. So I'm going to end here with an example of the position of freedom for a pure soul. And that one of our best examples is Narada Muni. Don't we always think of Narada Muni, traveling throughout the universes in a spiritual body? It almost seems like the embodiment of freedom, doesn't it? That's the free spirit soul. And Prabhupada describes it. This is from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 1.6.37.
The verse is, Sudha Goswami said, thus addressing Vyasadeva, Srila Narada Muni took leave of him, and vibrating on his Veena instrument, he left to wander at his free will. This word yadrichtika is there, wandering at one's free will. Prabhupada says, every living being is anxious for full freedom, because that is his transcendental nature. And this freedom is obtained only through transcendental service to the Lord. Illusion by the external energy, everyone thinks that he is free, but actually he is bound up by the laws of nature. A conditioned soul cannot freely move from one place to another, even on this earth. What to speak of from one planet to another? But a full-fledged, free soul like Narada, always engaged in chanting the Lord's glory, is free to move not only on earth, but also in any part of the universe, as well as any part of the spiritual sky. We can just imagine the extent and unlimitedness of his freedom, which is as good as that of the Supreme Lord. Similarly, the association of devotees is also free. One may be fortunate to have it or may not have it even after thousands of endeavors. Therefore, in all spheres of devotional service, freedom is the main pivot. Without freedom, there is no execution of devotional service. The freedom surrendered to the Lord does not mean that the devotee becomes dependent in every respect. To surrender unto the Lord through the transparent medium of the spiritual master is to attain complete freedom of life. Okay. So I have always liked that purport very much. Yeah, stop at that point. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Comments, questions? Oh, well, we'll start with the ladies first. Another Sukhita? All right, wait for them.
One question is, Narada Muni, wasn't he cursed, though, where he could only spend like a few minutes in one place?
Yes, and Prabhupada describes that was curse was really a benediction, in a sense, because then he was able to always travel and preach, and, you know, he didn't take it as, in fact, as, I think it was described he could counter the curse if he wanted, but he accepted it.
Okay. And the other thing is, I was reading in the story of Krishna kidnapping Rukmini, and how when the Brahman arrived, you know, to give Krishna the message, that Krishna took the Brahman's feet in his lap, and he was massaging his feet. And then Prabhupada talks about a Brahmana and how if someone is satisfied in mind, then he, you know, as a devotee, whatever situation he's in, then he can go back to Godhead. You know, it's like he said, even a king who may have so much opulence, if he's dissatisfied in mind, he'll have to take another birth to, like, become satisfied. But a devotee who even lost all possessions, if he's just satisfied with what little he has, then he can be happy and peaceful, do his service, go back to Godhead. So that's freedom, right?
Yeah.
Is being
exactly
completely satisfied in whatever situation.
Yes.
And it's such an art, and sometimes such an elusive art.
It really is, because the real shift, of course, in consciousness is from material to spiritual. And understanding the nature of spiritual relationships, the spiritual reality, it's so different. What we consider to be, you know, like something undesirable, like surrendering to someone else in the material world, surrendering to Krishna is the highest, as you said, it's the position that puts the devotee in complete happiness in any situation. However one finds himself in life, if you feel like I'm with Krishna, I'm with my guru, I'm rightly situated, then one is always feeling happy and free. Yeah? Thank you for that. Very nice. Yamaraj.
Thank you for your class, Prabhu. I just want to make a couple of comments. As far as Thomas Jefferson is concerned, he was a... He owned over 600 slaves,
mm-hmm.
and he talked a lot about freeing the slaves, but he never, in his lifetime,
In his will, I believe he did, but not while he was alive.
Right.
So there's always a little hypocrisy sometimes with our materialistic people, right?
And also, Prabhupada said we're not all created equal. And in my opinion, I don't think the Declaration of Independence is a great document, really, actually.
Well, we said created equal. Again, a lot of us... The problem is that very few people have a clear understanding between material and spiritual. And this is where the confusion comes. Because when you say inalienable rights of man to freedom, well, no, everyone isn't equal. As you say, we all have different bodies, we have different karma, we have different propensities, we have different abilities. That's on the bodily, on the material concept. Now, spiritually, of course, we are all equal. We are all the same spiritual nature, the same jiva, the same atma is there within every one of us. So I think there was a little glimmer of understanding this when they're talking about that everyone is equal, that we all have like equal opportunity. But again, it's a confusion or conflation of between the material and spiritual, and therefore, yes, it's certainly not on the level of Vaishnava philosophy. Agreed.
According to their opinions, I guess they were trying to come from the spiritual and the material platform, something like that.
Yeah. And again, just to clarify my point, mm-hmm. I said it was a very well-written document. I didn't say it was absolute truth.
Right. It might have been well-written. And as far as the... implementation of these, like the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, we can see that it's even today these documents are just nonsense, and they can't even control the executive branch. These documents were supposed to be made to have checks and balances.
You don't even want to get me started there.
Okay. Yeah.
So, Prabhu, you were mentioning earlier on about independence of the living entities. So I was thinking that the best use of our independence is to be completely dependent on the Lord, to use it in that way.
Yeah.
I know there are many times I heard discussions where that becomes like a conflicting idea of understanding of independence and dependence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, also, you were talking about freedom, so I want to just recollect one lecture I heard from Satrup Maharaj many years ago, and he described this bondage and now this aspect of freedom, that bondage of many lifetimes can be compared to one making a garbage pile. So, you know, they're always throwing all the garbage pile and eventually becomes a great mountain. Uh-huh. So when one gets in touch with Krishna consciousness, it's like he finding a shovel. It might be a small shovel, but then instead of adding more garbage to the pile, he starts to breaking down this hill. So in that way, he's free in that he's not adding more garbage to the pile, but he's breaking it away. So it may appears to be that it may take a while to completely break it away, but he's on the side of freedom. He's not on the side of bondage.
Going in the right direction.
Yes.
Prabhupada also gave the example of being in the shower. Right? He said, you know, you may be very dirty, but you're in the shower. In fact, he said you shouldn't criticize someone who's in the shower saying, oh, you're still dirty. Well, he's washing. He's trying to get clean. So we're moving in the right direction. Yeah. Anything else? Over here. Bhagavati.
Hare Krishna. I recently had my astrological chart done by Radhikesh Prabhu, and I recommend him. One of the, after going into some present and future things, let's look at the past. So I was amazed at some of the things he could see that had actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I then later reflected on it. I thought, gee, when those things were happening, I was thinking, I'm choosing. But it was right there visible to a good astrologer from the moment of my birth. So then I thought about how they say karma or fate is what happens to you, and the free will part is how you choose to respond.
Mm-hmm.
So there was even one case where, oh, this activity was clearly a bad activity, but it helped me come to Krishna consciousness because I was so remorseful.
Mm.
So just wanted to say that.
Yeah, that is a good point, because you can say, well, how do I have freedom? You know, how can I control the things that happen to me? You can't, really. I mean, due to our past activities, just the laws of nature, just the way this material world is. Like, sometimes devotees seem to be surprised when some distress comes to them. Prabhupada always said, why should we be surprised? We should be surprised if we're not in distress, or if we're not in it, because that's the nature of this material world. And as you said so nicely, what the devotee has, our free will, is in choice of how we respond. You know, do we see it in a Krishna conscious way? Do we see it as a lesson, perhaps? Do we learn from it? And do we try to use it to increase our Krishna consciousness and devotional service? Or do we let it distract us or take us away or whatever? So yeah, that's really the free will, isn't it? The free will is the choice. Do we act in Maya or do we act in Krishna consciousness? Yeah. That's probably a good point to stop. Thank you all very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.